Good morning. It's time to start our CareCast, brought to you by the Knowledge and Evaluation Research Unit. I'm Victor Montori, and transmitting from Mayo Clinic. And today we have an outstanding episode, thanks to the generosity of the always brilliant Dr. Doreen Ravi. So Dr. Ravi is professor of medicine and head of the endocrinology and metabolism division at the University of Calgary. She's an academic endocrinologist, a health services researcher, and an ardent advocate for inclusive medicine. As a leader of the Canadian Clinical Practice Guidelines, Dr. Ravi is focused on improving person-centered care and the practice of shared decision-making through the development of situational literacy. I have to say that Dr. Ravi is also an ardent advocate, not only for patients, but for the inclusion, equity, and diversity in medicine and healthcare. Doreen, welcome to the CareCast.
Oh, thank you. Welcome. Thank you so much for welcoming me, and it's going to be a pleasure.
Absolutely. And so, Doreen, we always start our conversations here by asking you, how does one become Doreen Ravi?
I think, like many people, I've had it's been a journey, having watched the CareCast before, I know you always like to talk about how much of it was, you know, sort of purposeful and strategic, and how much of it was serendipitous. And I think in my case, it was largely serendipitous, and mostly, I have been very, very fortunate, very, very lucky. But I've also, you know, I've had a few less lucky moments. But I think, When I reflect on what were the most formative experiences in terms of bringing me to this point in my life, I think the first experience was certainly being a patient myself. And so when I was 15, I was diagnosed with anorexia. And at the time, it was a very severe case. And I was about 5'6" at the time, and I weighed about 75 pounds. So I was very emaciated. I looked very ill. I required a lot of care. I was in and out of hospital for my sophomore and junior years of high school. I was in and out of care, but I was often hospitalized for months at a time. And you know, that experience was in lots of ways extraordinarily hard. I mean, I think it's a mental illness is something that's very isolating. It's very painful, not only to the person who's experiencing it, but to their families. Because I looked very ill, I had the experience of sometimes being met with significant compassion, where people would be like, "Oh my goodness!" Like, you know, they'd be worried I had some sort of terrible consumptive illness, and you know, and then there'd sort of be a flip when they realized I was actually mentally ill, and then they'd be like, "My God, what's wrong with her?" So having that sort of those, and then my parents also experiencing that, like sometimes these moments of like grave concern and these other moments of judgment. And so I think, you know, sort of having that experience of feeling very different, feeling a bit marginalized, you know, I that sits with me to this day. I was also extremely fortunate to have a wonderful care team. And as I was, you know, as I think about the experience now, I was also receiving care in a time before evidence-based medicine was really a thing. I had this care team that wasn't constrained necessarily by some of the clinical guidance that they might have now. And I was very fortunate that my care team really was just very committed to working with me and being patient and trying to navigate through things together. And particularly my pediatric team. And so it was, in retrospect, one of my first very positive experiences with, to some extent, shared decision-making in a time before it was really formalized. I just had this very loving team that, especially my nurses, that went out of their way to just really see the person in me. welcomed me into spaces that I don't think many patients often get to see. I remember very fondly, you know, not being able to sleep at night and the nurses letting me sit around the nursing station with them and having a cup of tea and just chatting and just feeling very, very welcome and very normal and, you know, very connected. And I think that was a very powerful thing in terms of my healing.
So it's interesting that as you start to tell us about your trajectory of becoming you, the first experience is of course, this challenge of being a patient and a chronically ill patient and a chronically ill patient with a mental illness, but also one of these formative experiences is to encounter a caring team that mm-hmm. finds way of bringing you in. So these are substantial formative experiences.
Oh, incredibly. And then I think that because it was so long, of course, I had a variety of experiences. I think the first ones were very, very, were incredibly compassionate. But then as I aged out of pediatric care and went into adult care, it was a very different paradigm. And it was also very interesting in terms of, I think I mentioned this to you before, that at times it felt very, like I almost was on an anthropological study, that I was like sort of, especially as an adolescent patient on a general medical unit for like literally 2 months, I saw a lot of stuff, a lot of medicine, a lot of, I just had a lot of exposure to how things operate in, the medical industrial complex. And so that was also, a very, very informative experience. And I think the other thing that it gave me an early education on was social determinants. And so, especially on a general medical unit, when I was there for as long as I was, number of roommates that had a variety of complex chronic conditions. Really remarkable that, some of the things that stand out is, sort of the social status and social situations of younger patients that were there with complex disease relative to patients that, presented more older with similar conditions. And so, it was a remarkable time for me, for sure. And I think that,
you could see this social extraction showing up in some sort of, did I get it right? Did you perceive a hierarchy within the hospitalized patients that
Serve
another?
Oh, absolutely. Like I think, and even for myself, like I even on the pediatric unit, I adored my care team, but, I roomed with a couple of other teenagers that had mental health challenges, then came from slightly different backgrounds. And as much as I love my team, I to say that maybe we were treated the same, I'm not sure we were. I think
we're talking about Canada here, right? I mean, south of the border of the Canadian border, we see Canada as a more equal country, perhaps, than the United States. But you were able to perceive this in that microcosm of your hospitalization.
Yeah, I was, and I think that there was, I think that the, perhaps what I perceived is a little less patience with, families that came from a different background than I did. I think that I have the knowledge now that sometimes that frustration may not have been directed at the patient, may have been directed at the situation, may have been directed at the family, may have been directed at sort of just my care team or the care providers on the floor may have just felt that a lot of their efforts or a lot of their intervention was sort of futile because of the lack of winning conditions on the patient side. I don't know, but I definitely could see that there was there was a differential application of compassion and understanding at times, or at least that was my perception then. But the other thing that was quite clear is that at the time was that just that the severity of some of these chronic conditions certainly seemed to run across, at the time, even at that time, I could sort of see that they cut across socioeconomic lines.
Yeah, I would have thought that that periods of time where one is sick, one becomes self-absorbed, but the prolonged stay allowed you to probably get out of your own situation and look around, and you probably had already wherewithal to begin to analyze what's going on, right?
I think the nature of my illness was that I didn't think I was so sick, right? And that I was pretty, like, I thought I was fine. So I think that while there were a number of traumas that led me to behave in that way and led, you know, me to, you know, to perpetually hurt myself in terms of just, you know, not providing myself with the sustenance that I needed. I was also, I think a big part of my identity was a learner. I was a good student, and that's how I was known. And so I think that there was this part of me that just felt it was my obligation. I'm in this new environment and I need to absorb it. And I wanted to go into medicine. I knew at that time I wanted to be
a physician. You knew it already.
I already knew it. And I think that, I don't think I was conscious about the fact that this was a, you know, potential, you know, learning opportunity. But I as it turns out, that's how I did observe a lot, and I did take away a ton from that experience beyond just what I needed to get myself on a path to wellness.
Do you remember when you chose to go into medicine?
Yeah, actually I was younger. I was actually 10. And there was a couple of things. Yeah, 10. Yeah.
I mean, I'm thinking I'm going to be an astronaut or,
Yeah. No, I'll tell you, like, it's a, yeah, I mean, it's because there's some insights into probably like, sort of the, how my brain works. But I, so as a little one, like my mom went back to work when I was in grade 2, and I thought that was the most amazing thing. Like, I was just so proud of her. Like, she'd gone back to school and she had trained and she went back into work. And I was just like, I was like a cheerleader for my mom in a way that I think she found rather annoying, because she's just like, it's not that big of a deal. But I was just like, telling everybody at school, and I just thought it was amazing that she was a working mom. And I think, at the time I remember, being asked, like, what do you want to do when you grow up? And I had all of these, you know, I really thought that the choice of career opportunities was very limited. And I gave very traditional gendered kind of professions is my response to those questions. And then, I had a neighbor that was a nurse, and I just thought she was like, I was really fascinated by her work. And I always wanted to talk to her about her work. And I said, I think I want to be a nurse. And she's like, you know, I'll tell you, Doreen, like, I think you'd be happier being a physician. And then I was like, okay. And that was just, it was interesting that, you know, I never even thought of that until she had sort of suggested it. And then just sort of on the heels of that, the other experience I had was one of my best friend's mother was diagnosed with breast cancer. Mm. And then sort of watching what that did to her family, was something that was incredibly impactful. And to the point that I actually did a grade 5 project on cancer. So that also speaks to like the kind of kid I was pretty serious.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. I was pretty focused.
So you know, you became a physician, and then you became nationally active on guidelines. And
yeah,
how does that happen?
So, well, I think that was again just luck. I think I've just been very, very fortunate to connect with some really incredible people that have just been kind enough to give me opportunities. And so the guidelines work really came out of, there was a colleague of mine, Nadia Khan, who is a wonderful mentor, and she's a general internist in British Columbia. And she she actually just stepped down as president of Hypertension Canada, where she was the chair at the time when she invited me on to the guideline panel as a reviewer. And so that was in 2010. And so, yeah, it was just one of those things that I was always quite good in data synthesis methods. And so it was a natural fit. And I really liked the community, got lots of academic opportunities in terms of writing, got lots of networking opportunities. It was just a really lovely, you know, professional experience. And then I was asked to chair the methods review committee and then chair the guidelines committee. And I became chair of the guidelines committee in 2016. And so, yeah, that was just, and I'll just say for any of the medical learners out there, you know, I went into the guidelines at a stage in my career, in my mid-career, early mid-career, which is often a very difficult time. You know, it's, you know, when you come on staff as an early, as a young academic, you know, you're sort of seeing this person with all this promise, you know, you're starting to get awards and, you know, people are celebrating you and you're like, oh, you're a rising star. And then I think it's quite common, I think for women in particular, when they sort of transition to mid-career, that you start to feel like you were a person that had promise. And mm-hmm. and that can be a very crushing time, I think. And because, you know, you sort of, you know, and you start to have this anxiety about what am I going to do next? And it's a bit of a, like, I think academia does this weird thing to one's mind in terms of really, 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 really nurturing a lot of self-doubt. And I think because of how the hierarchies and the meritocracy of medicine work, there are people that do get consistently left out and do get consistently left behind and through, not through any reason related to the quality of their work, but purely related to who they are and how our institutes are structured. And so the guidelines was a wonderful experience for me because it was something outside my institution. I was being validated in this other environment, which was, I think for me, something that buoyed me and kept me going at a time when I think that my home institution was making me wonder about, you know, sort of my value and my future a little bit. And I have to be like, I'm very, very grateful for my environment here at the University of Calgary. But, I think that, you know, with where the way our world works and with our annual reporting and with the pressure to produce, there's an ambient culture of what have you done for me lately that can get a little hard, I think on the spirit at times. So that was a wonderful experience that way. But I think, where the guidelines, you know, it's interesting where it's brought me now is that, you know, reflecting back on my experience as a patient, you know, in a time where, you know, it was in 87, it was sort of before, you know, evidence-based medicine had really become a thing, before guidelines were really there. And I wonder at times if, again, if there had been that structure around, you know, what my care team thought should happen and what they were being told, well, this is, if you're a good physician, this is what you'll do, how that may have changed the experience. I sometimes think it would be less caring if that happened.
It's the second time you imply that in this conversation that there's an association that you're making between evidence-based practice and rigidity or less caring approaches. Am I getting that right?
Yeah. I think at times, having been in the guideline space for so long, and I'm still in the guideline space, but it's an interesting space to be in right now. Cause I think we're all realized that we've got to shift a little bit. And I think that, sort of the shared decision-making discussions have gained enough momentum and enough visibility now that we really need to realize we have to make guidelines, you know, work in a slightly different way and we need to translate them in a different way. But I do think for some time that although it was never conceived to be this, and I think David Sackett never intended for evidence and clinical guidance tools to dictate or, you know, overly prescribe care. And he had even written an editorial in the BMJ in 1995 about, you know, care should be evidence-based, not evidence-burdened. And I think that particularly recently, when you look at sort of how much clinical guidance is out there, I think we may have tipped over into that evidence-burdened zone where we, I think physicians, clinicians feel very bound to evidence. Our quality indicators are very bound to evidence. And so the frameworks we have to give feedback on, is your care effective? Is your care high quality? All tied to evidence and don't tie enough to the patient experience or the caring experience. So I worry at times that this tool that was intended to create a unified standard of care and ensure ensure equity in terms of the care experience actually may have went sideways a little bit and created more distance between clinicians and patients and that's where I kind of sit now.
Self-doubt that you were talking about that academia and medical training offers to people and then is selecting in some ways to people who then get trained to please and not disappoint and not be found out that perhaps they're not as they don't belong, that they're this imposter syndrome, you know, just flourishes in that space. And then you have a guideline that comes that comes around and says, if you practice this way, you can sneak by, you know, you may not be found. Right. And so
exactly.
And people might actually find it to be a good crutch and a good way of feeling like you're competent simply because if nothing else, the other signs that you're doing well might not be as strong in an environment in which you don't have much continuity with patients or much time with them to realize whether you're actually doing any good to them. In the long run, because there is no long run, particularly, I mean, you and I have specialty practices and sometimes, you know, continuity of care and longitudinal relationships are hard to come by. I tease the cardiologists, I tell them that they don't practice evidence-based medicine. They're suffering from evidence tyranny, you know, because yes. any trial comes out, you know, A is better than B, then everybody has to give A.
Yes.
So how do you go from there to now? I mean, anybody that's been following on social media will see that you've come to be an international leader in equity, diversity, and inclusion. How has that transition taken place? Or maybe there's no transition. It's always been there, but it's just become known as part of your persona more recently.
I think equity has always been a principle that's driven what I do and who I am. Like I think even as I started my practice, and some of this relates to, again, sort of my own experience as a patient, that I had this awareness that, you have to really, really examine the clinician-patient relationship carefully to avoid it becoming inequitable. It's stacked to be an inequitable relationship. And there was things that just bothered me in terms of, you know, I'd be, you know, we advise patients to, you know, to do a lot of work to look after themselves with diabetes. And I think that when I started my practice, I had very little children. And I remember once, talking to another young mom who was a pumper and, you know, sort of saying, I think we have to do some basal checks. And this was back before CGM. And so that just meant she couldn't eat and she'd have to test her blood sugars hourly. And I just remember saying, if I were in her position with little kids, and then someone told me you have to do some basal checks, I would just cry. And I think it was that I remember that conversation in particular, just being something that just made me just really, really think about what it is that I'm asking of patients on a regular basis. And then sort of looking at how we construct medicine, right? And that, you know, there's this crazy unfairness of, you know, sort of saying that, you know, patients come in for assessment and for advice and for guidance and for care, and they often leave with homework. And, you know, and then if they have any challenges with their homework, there's very limited channels through which they can access you. They can only access you during certain hours. They can only call one number often, you know, there's this assumption that they have to call you by your title, but you can call them by their name. And there's all these things that just, you know, kind of make clinicians often unapproachable. And so early on, I just was uncomfortable with that. So I've always wanted them to call me by my first name. I've always given my email. I've always given my cell. Like, it's just like, if, you know, you shouldn't be riding this alone. If you're having challenges, like, give me a ring and, you know, we'll work it out together. Interestingly, people often, you know, are kind of surprised that I do that, and then are often very tentative about using those resources. But I just think on principle, I should make them available. And then I also feel it's really unfair that I get to ask them all sorts of personal questions and they don't get to know anything about me. So I think people over the years, I've always been very open. If people want to ask me about my life, like they should and they can. And I don't think that that my practice or my care is worse off for that. Like I think it's actually, I'd say it's better for that. In terms of my own professional experience, it's gratifying and very, very fulfilling. You know, when patients come and ask about my kids or, you know, remember when my birthday was, or it's just, I'm very touched. I think care is just so much better. And as you say, we have the good fortune of these longitudinal relationships. I get to meet people when they're teenagers and I get to see them have their children and I get to see them, you know, through their lives and to the good and the bad. And it's such a gift to be able to ride shotgun in people's lives like that. So, but that's where the equity came in, I think, is mostly that I just feel that there's so much about people that we interact with that we don't take the time to understand or learn about. And there's these hidden aspects of people's lives that when we take the time to, you know, kind of ask and learn, it can take you in very, very unexpected, but also extraordinarily rewarding directions.
Mm-hmm. So equity as a guiding value of your career, in our unit, we have three principles that we go by, you know, patient-centeredness, integrity, and generosity. Any of these ring particularly strongly with you?
Yeah, generosity, for sure. And I think, I've been very fortunate to have many generous mentors through my career. I mentioned Nadia Khan and my co-chair at the guidelines, Stella Daskalupolo. She's just a lovely, lovely person who's extraordinarily generous with her time and her knowledge. My partner Bill is a big model of generous leadership. The interactions that we've had, I'm always struck by people. And again, Bill's a great example of this, who's someone that goes out there and is he's an extrovert to begin with, but there's never puts a limit on time, never puts a limit on what he's willing to give to elevate another person and boost another person. So I've benefited from that kind of mentorship. I try to take that approach and pass the love forward, so to speak.
Well, it's pretty evident to anybody that has interacted with you that generosity is like in a Star Wars type of way, will be this generosity strong in you, like the Force. What's been your favorite collaboration?
Oh, Mike, I think, I've had, again, very fortunate to have many. I think, my kids are a huge part of my life and the best part of my life. I think my family has been a lifelong collaboration, and I've learned so much from my parents and my brothers but my children are I'm obviously biased, but I think they're amazing young people. I think this anthropologist in me, I think sometimes I took sort of a bit of an anthropologic approach to my kids as well, and just, you know, always wanted to observe them and just sort of really understand the people that they were and try to create environments, you know, that were personal to them, that allowed them to succeed. And I think that I've always people often sort of say, you know, like everything, you know, democracy is great, but families, it's not so, you know, it's not necessarily so much of a democracy and parents get to have some authority. I'm not sure that my house runs that way. My kids have a fair bit of a fair bit of direction and a fair bit of authority over me at times, but I quite like that. I think my I've learned a lot from my kids. They, I'm amazed at how equity-minded they naturally are. I'm also struck by, and really sort of, you know, very, very heartened by how politically active they are. They, you know, like as all teenagers, they're really good at keeping their parents humble. And I think that they've been pretty vocal about the things that they feel that, you know, their grandparents' generation, that our generation, you know, didn't do terribly well. And I see this in my students as well, that, you know, I think youth often get dismissed as being unwise or being, you know, a bit too sentimental. And the truth is that passion and that heart are such lovely, lovely things. And I think the students I've worked with in particular are remarkable organizers. Their voices are incredibly powerful, but they're not often heard. And I think this is another thing that sort of pushed me to where I am now is some frustration that these young voices that are brilliant and hopeful, but also pained at times, don't get the attention that they should get. Mm-hmm. and I think that, especially in medicine, are the way we're structured and the hierarchies we have, that those student voices are often quelled. And I just think that it's a shame. Like students have really inspired and transformed the way I think, and as my kids have. And so I just I think that my young collaborators are definitely hold a spot in my heart for sure.
It's interesting because you've done what might be a couple of head fakes in that one, because on the one hand, as you were saying, my household might not appear like a democracy. And then I was thinking that what will follow is that you will be some sort of tyrant, that, you know, but it's actually your kids running you.
That was the first fake.
And then the second one is that you're finding your best collaborations in people that perhaps if I were to ask them, there will be describing themselves as looking up to you or learning from you, admiring you and so forth. They may not see you as a collaborator, but you pretty much see them as teaching you and helping you be better. Did I get that right?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that, and my patients as well, and I shouldn't say my patients, they're not, I try not to use possessive language but the patients that I work with, similarly, I think that, I have learned so much, and and again, this is the generosity, right? Is that all patients that come and are, you know, trust you, and are comfortable enough with you to lay out some pretty personal and intimate stuff. I mean, that's extraordinarily generous. Mm. And again, I think that I've been struck by how that generosity has truly been transformative in how I think and how I do things.
When you think about thinking now about your academic work, as a physician, as a researcher, as an academic leader, what do you think is the meaning of the work that you're doing?
What I hope, I think if, you know, and it's sorry, just like, I'm going to tangent a little bit, but I promise I'll come back. But I think, you know, again, sort of thinking about sort of this early to mid career experience, or sort of that transition from early career to mid career, where again, you're sort of, you know, you've had an early career investigator award, and, you know, you're sort of validated that, okay, you've got some good ideas, kid, let's see what you can do. And then in that mid career where, you know, you're trying to really establish yourself and you've often finished a first program of work, and you're trying to figure out how to reinvent yourself. And And this is when, you know, more awards and things like that become really important in terms of, you know, kind of giving you opportunities. And at that time I struggled a little bit, and I still, I think again, with medicine, we are pleasers. We are looking to make sure that we're doing the right thing. And we've set up a system where we're quite dependent on those external, you know, those regular boluses of external validation. And I was struck that, you know, year after year, I was, again, the sort of my confidence in myself and my joy in work was being eroded, knowing that I was needing those things. And I think I've gotten to a place in my career, and partly it was, I think just serendipitous connection with a couple of, you know, of really important mentors, just sort of maybe really challenge, why are those things important? And, you know, really at the end of the day, like what is it that I want to do? And what is it that is most meaningful? And do I need those things to tell me that those things are good? And I think that I'm very grateful to those people, that have made me see that. I think that if I were to say what do I want my work to accomplish? What's the meaning of my work? Is actually, I'd like to, you know, be someone who nudges major culture shift. I'd like to, you know, kind of think that some of the work that we're doing right now might really challenge how we're thinking about how things are structured, and how our structures are actually contributing to a lot of harm. And I think harm for patients in terms of, again, we've got these hierarchies that are very oppressive, that continue to harm patients, that continue to erode relationships between patients and clinicians. I think that within academia, we have an educational system. The medical education system in particular is also quite oppressive, and not equally so. It's generally oppressive, but particularly oppressive to racialized learners. And so I think, you know, just sort of I hope that the lens of equity that I bring to the work that I do, and my genuine commitment to equity, will start to, again, sort of, you know, start some of these more challenging discussions about, do we really want to continue this? Do we really, do we really want to continue engaging in preventable harm when we can be so much better?
Mm-hmm. So to help us understand what you mean by oppression.
Well, I think, you know, when I use the word, I use it as a, you know, I think that there's, I think I basically want to communicate that there are times when people are really left without freedom or choice. Hmm. And there is, it's a combination of, there's a removal of choice. There's a removal of autonomy. And there's, I think that the people who are experiencing oppression often feel that there's a lack of control in those situations. And unfortunately with that, a lack of hope. So I think it's a combination of all of those things. I think it's a withdrawal of hope. It's a withdrawal of dignity, and it's a sense that there's little choice and little option for them, and the only path forward is the path that someone who they perceive has control over them is telling them to take. And I think that.
So it's just drawing a parallel, you know, so you go into healthcare as a patient, you get care, and you describe ways in which care can be cruel to people when it, for instance, fails to capture, understand what's going on, or where it throws, in addition to care, throws stigma into the picture, as, you know, you discuss the that shift between, oh, you must be very sick, you know, maybe you have uncontrolled diabetes or it's mental illness. Oh, okay, that's a different story, right? So that shift, that's cruel. But now you describe in education a parallel syndrome in the sense that, or a parallel phenomenon in the sense that, Amartya Sen and Martha Nussbaum, for instance, talked about people having capacity and what society, what it does is it looks to remove all the barriers for people to flourish and manifest that capacity and manifest their potential. I'm thinking of Malala Yousaf, being being shot because she wanted to go to school and learn, the patriarchy where she was growing up, would not tolerate a girl having those types of ambitions. But that seems very extreme, getting shot in the face because you want to learn. That seems a very extreme, very in your face form of oppression. How does it manifest in medical education, you think? Because again, you go there trying to flourish, and then you're telling me, no, there is a mechanism of oppression that is preventing that exact thing from happening. Give me an example how that ends up happening.
Well, I think in medicine, it's what's most sinister about how it happens in medicine is it's invisible. Like you actually have to really look for it. And I think in terms of, there's been quite a bit discussed thanks to sort of the work of, several leaders in this area, Esther Chu and Arga Gonzalez. Like there's a number of very, very notable women that have been out there talking about sort of the gender gap in pay and gender gap in opportunity. And we see it in, we see it in academia, but we even see it in clinical outcomes. I started my career looking at gender differences and sex differences in cardiovascular care in women with diabetes men and women with diabetes. But we see these subtle biases play out in terms of women's how women are engaged in terms of clinical decision making, how women are perceived when they present with symptoms. There's these biases that just continue to play out. And I think as clinicians that are trained in science, we believe that we're not prone to making those systematic errors. That's the tricky thing is that we've convinced ourselves that we are not creatures of bias, that we are creatures of science. And so it's a fascinating thing that when you start revealing these systematic errors that nearly half of all women that present with ischemic heart disease aren't recognized as having ischemic heart disease at the first presentation. They're dismissed as something else. When you look at the representation of Black, Indigenous, or students of color in medical school, it's significantly lower than it is in the population. We make systematic errors. We just aren't very good at recognizing them or acknowledging them. And then this plays out throughout people's education, out through their careers, and it plays out, for several patients as they interact with the healthcare system. There's an experience of, all these interactions with the healthcare system that leave them feeling disbelieved or feeling invalidated. That adds up, and it leads to very well earned distrust of the medical system. And I think for students and that have experienced those experience, which may be overt, aggressive acts of interpersonal sexism or racism, or they may be maybe very subtle, exclusions and omissions. But over several years and over decades, it leads to quite significant trauma and quite significant hurt. And as you mentioned, a tragic loss of opportunity that ultimately, is something we all, we all suffer from. That's amazing. There's a, I think, yeah.
This series is about care that fits, and the efforts that clinicians in the office make with patients when they work together to try to craft programs of care that makes intellectual, emotional, and practical sense to people, and of course the work people that then have to do at home or in their life to try to make that care program, you know, fit with all the mm-hmm. other demands and routines of their life. How does this lens that you bring work in to make care fit better?
Well, I think, you know, we just submitted a grant on situational literacy, and situational literacy is this construct that, you know, kind of as our team kind of developed. And it's this idea that it's the recognition that every person is going to, you know, come to the table with, you know, a certain degree of medical complexity and a certain degree of life complexity. And situational literacy is that understanding of how those two things interact in this person. And it's, we wanted to use the term literacy because it's not just a competency. It's not just a set of skills. It's this enhanced understanding. It's this ability to communicate, to truly understand, to be fluent in the lived experience, essentially. And I think that since submitting the grant and sort of thinking about sort of the, you know, your book and the language that we use in the Patient Revolution, it's really a different way of approaching sort of seeing someone in high definition. And I think that you know, when we were sort of trying to come up with this construct of situational literacy and thinking about situational literacy and the importance of it in shared decision-making, I was left with, again, this idea that, you know, when you have a clinician-patient duo, and I'm not going to say they're partners yet, because I think that partnership is something that's earned. It's not something that's a given. And the way we develop that partnership is you know, trying to close the gap that naturally will exist between a patient and a clinician. Again, our structures bring these two people together in a way that's not entirely voluntary. You know, a patient is assigned through some sort of central access and triage process. There's no, you know, and at least in Canada, that's how it happens. And then patients, you know, are there, you know, not because they necessarily, you know, often because they don't want to be there. They have a diagnosis. They have pain. They have unwanted disability. They have, you know, unwanted symptoms. And so they're sitting there with this imposed state. And, you know, physicians come in with a very chosen state, in my case, chosen at, you know, age 10. And so it's a very, very, very unequal playing field. And I think that I think our hypothesis is that if it, you know, physicians, clinicians, you know, it's, you know, to make that environment more comfortable, more safe for shared decision-making, to ensure that the trust is there so that that process will go well. Because again, physicians often think we're doing something that we do all the time. We think we're really good at shared decision-making, but the data would suggest we don't do it very often and we don't necessarily do it fairly well. We don't necessarily do it really well. Mm. And I think, again, because we're sort of caught up in the process and we're caught up in the method, and we sort of kind of forget that a key part of shared decision making is really, really, really understanding the experience of the person in front of you, and getting them comfortable and getting them you know, to trust. And I think that the way that patients trust, especially patients who've experienced trauma, who've had adverse experiences in the past, is you know, for you to take that time, to take that effort to become fluent in their lived experience. And the physician needs to be the learner in that scenario to get to that point of partnership.
So you've in this discussion, you've taken us through two kinds of challenges, I think, in seeing the patient in high definition. Initially, I think the challenge of stigmatized conditions that perhaps are not fully understood, that really strain the ability of whoever is called to care professionally, a clinician or friend or family that comes to the side of the sufferer. There's the ability to act with compassion towards someone that's going through something that you perhaps have difficulty fully understanding or capturing. And that's almost on the biological side. And then you're bringing up an additional level of complexity, which is fully understanding the biographical and historical challenges that a person is going through. Caring for people is hard if one has to do all these things, right?
It is. It's really rewarding, though. I think with anything, like it becomes, I think the concept of love has been discussed, a lot in this Carecast. And I think that, love doesn't come easy. You've got to, you do have to work at it, and relationships take work and take time and take dedication. And so I think that, and this is again where we have to look at our structures. We don't value that currently in how we've structured care. It becomes too easy to not take the time.
Check the box, do the guideline. So
exactly.
A student that's trying to get, be like you and work well in healthcare, finds those structures. You describe them as oppressive, restrictive, limiting, channeling. Perhaps you know what you stay on your lane, so to speak. Is your advice to a student to stay in your lane and conform and get it through? And once you get to my level, then you speak out, or do you set them out to fail, so to speak, because they become the troublemaker and the person that is this uncomfortable and trying to raise the issues you're raising, but at the point where they have, as you pointed out before, nobody's listening to their voice, they have no power, and they're desperately trying to fit in. So what should a young person to do in that sort of situation?
Yeah, I think this is something I actually think a lot about, because I think that particularly, one of the things when you spend a lot of time in the equity, diversity, and inclusive space, and you're trying to figure out how do we desperately need to be a more diverse clinician community. There's so much evidence from the corporate world in particular that the more inclusive we are in terms of, just having good representation from the disabled community, from LGBTQ2+ community, from racialized communities, like the more representation we have, the more diversity of life experience we have, the more views we have, the better we are. We just think more creatively. We think more compassionately. We problem solve in such a better way. There's just so many reasons to be inclusive, beyond just that it's morally important to be inclusive. But I think the thing is that when you have these existing structures that we know are harmful, you have to, we feel this urgency to be as inclusive and diverse as possible, but we have to make sure we're doing the work on the other side to ensure that we're actively knocking down those things that are going to hurt people. If our systems and our structures, are oppressive, they are hurtful. And we need to be actively knocking those things down and challenging those things to ensure that we don't hurt this diverse community that we're trying to grow. And so along those lines is, again, sort of how do we coach students, and what's our responsibility to keep those students safe, and give them an environment where they can thrive. I think that's really tricky.
Do you recommend your colleagues and other teachers that are in contact with those students to foster those challenges, or how do you create an environment for students to be able to kind of open up their wings and show us a different trajectory than the one that we've set up for them?
Well, I'm hopeful at this point that we've got, I'm very fortunate right now that I'm in a position where I have a leadership position within my, you know, within my medical school. So I can start, you know, sort of busting some things up and, you know, work with students to rebuild them in a way that's far better and healthier. I have leadership in a compartment in a bigger organization. So sort of busting through all of those other walls is something that's a work in progress. I am very grateful to be at the University of Calgary right now, because I do think we have leadership at a variety of levels that's really quite open to some serious demolition and reconstruction. That's inclusive and healthy and loving. So it's an exciting time. I recently was given a new position where I have a few more opportunities to bust some things up and do some things differently. And was a little surprised that I was offered the position, but at the same time, really, you know, heartened that people know what I like to do. Going back to the very beginning of the discussion, sort of, I've been fortunate enough to be able to, you know, get the opportunity to do it. So I think there needs to be a commitment from leadership, you know, to restructuring things. And I think it's very, very, very difficult to make those changes unless you've got, you know, sort of leaders that are willing to say, okay, like, we're a little uncertain of what the next phase will look like, but we trust that, you know, you'll take us in the right direction. And I have to say, like, it's just like, it's something that still continues to move me that I might be someone who can help with that shift towards something that's healthier.
If they say that the arch of history bends towards justice, it's probably because of people like you that's pulling it down. So you're pulling it in that direction. Doreen, it's been a wonderful gift to have you in the CareCast and to see your clarity and your courage and your commitment to students, commitment to young people, and to create a better world. And it's been a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Excellent. And thanks everyone else for joining us. Please join us for our next CareCast, brought to you by the CARE Unit, and please take care.